Thank you very much for this opportunity of talking to you. Now, as Victor said, it's now been 18 years, coming on to 18 years since the first edition of The Crest of the Peacock came out. Now, I'm now in the process of adding and changing for the third edition. And one of the sort of points that was made fairly early on when the book came out was that it contained a lot of politics and very little mathematics. This was one of the sort of criticisms made of it. And so that in part explains what is the title of the talk that I have taken, which is The Politics of Writing Histories of Non-Western Mathematics. Now, one of the great benefits, at least, that both my wife and I have got as a result of this book is being that it's given us an opportunity to travel to all sorts of different parts of the world. A lot of the areas outside North America and Europe. And the course of these travels have been able to interact and exchange ideas with a whole number of different groups of people. And one of the things that one notices is that as part of this contact, there are four questions that are quite frequently discussed by audiences, by individuals in a number of countries and outside Europe or North America. I think the first question is, why are non-Western contributions generally neglected in histories of science? Not just specifically mathematics, but histories of science. A second question is, why is there such difficulty for new evidence on non-Western contributions to become accepted and then percolate into standard histories of science? The third question is, this is rather long, but I think, I hope you bear with me what I am trying to say here. Why is there a tendency to assume that the holy grail of objectivity and balance has to be guarded jealously against biased opinion and special pleading on the part of non-Western scholars? And finally, the fourth question is, what explains the tendency to apply different standards of evidence when considering Western and non-Western contribution to scientific knowledge? I've tried to summarize, in a sense, and probably simplify in some sense, a number of issues that are sort of brought out by people as far away as New Zealand, number of African countries, Southeast Asian countries, West Indies, etc. Now, in trying to answer these questions, there have been the answers that one has tried to seek or in this are to an extent summarized by some of the following points. One is, there was a view, which is now probably much less prevalent, particularly with some of the more recent texts and books that have been written, that mathematics is essentially a European creation, a creation that arose from Greece, and then it was taken up after a considerable period of time by taken up by the Europeans. Now, so this is a particular view that exists, and this is a view that may partly provide an answer to the questions that I put. Secondly, as a part of this particular idea of it being a European creation, the contributions, there have been omissions of contributions from other cultures, there have been appropriations from, that is, certain mathematical results or theories have been appropriated from the countries where they originated and then taken up as a European creation. And there have been also exclusions of particular things. Part of the answer probably lies in differing perceptions on the origins of mathematics. Now, these points are not sort of in any way mutually exclusive. They tend to be some sort of ideas that I would like to suggest may probably lie behind the answers to the four questions that I suggested. Differing perceptions on the origins of mathematics. Now, to understand that better, one should understand it in terms of what I have sort of suggested in the first chapter of the book as some of the Eurocentric trajectories. The idea that mathematics originated, as I mentioned earlier, in Greece, and then followed by the Dark Ages, and then followed by it being ideas from Greece being developed and extended by different parts of Europe. This type of Eurocentric trajectories are probably now things of the past in a way. Even over the 18 years since my book came out, I think there's been very considerable changes, modifications, additions to the sort of origins of mathematics, the way that origins of mathematics are perceived. Now, one of the most interesting areas where there is still considerable controversy and considerable amount of interest is on transmissions. That is, once certain ideas come up, are these ideas in turn transmitted to other cultures, to other traditions, and so on? Again, there are differing perceptions on this, and that's really basically that, and what I call the problem of invisibility is what I want to address as part of what I see as a politics of writing the history of mathematics. Transmissions of mathematical ideas and how one sees these transmissions. So, what I would like to suggest is that we pass beyond the stage of Eurocentrism, which was the sort of central idea in what I indicate in the first chapter of my book, and we are now more concerned with getting a better picture of how transmissions took place and what I call the problem of invisibility. Now, I'm going to put this idea of the problem of invisibility, and you'll find on my sort of thing there's more writing than usual, simply because some of the ideas are quite difficult to express in a succinct manner. By invisibility, one means that there is no mention or acknowledgement or transmission, borrowing of any kind, even when circumstantial evidence may be compelling. More about circumstantial evidence in a minute. So that there is no acknowledgement at all or no mention of transmission. borrowing of any kind, even when the evidence is compelling. Now, there are two forms of invisibility, of which possibly the partial one is the one that one is more concerned with today. The total one is where there is no mention, no acknowledgement of the non-Western provenance of the item of knowledge, information, invention, and is passing it off as a native phenomenon. The partial one, which is what is more pervasive now, is reference may be made to a possible non-Western provenance, but the impression given that the probability is low in terms of its priority or transmission. Now, the invisibility, the issue of invisibility is examined in terms of two types of evidence. One is the gold standard of proof, which I'll define, and circumstantial evidence, which I'll go on to define next. Now, gold standard of proof is as such. Nothing counts unless one gets hold of a document in archives or libraries which states that a particular culture, Y, has borrowed from another culture, X, borrowed X, which is a particular idea, from another culture, Z, on such and such a date and such and such a place. Unless such evidence exists, then, in a sense, one doesn't allow for any possibility of transmission. Now, this is sort of a legal analogy, and I want to continue with that legal analogy as follows. Now, basically, the idea of gold standard of proof, the way I got this idea from the notion of a legal contract in civil law, to be the prototype of what constitutes impeccable and impregnable evidence for asserting a claim of entitlement, property, goods, or services, such as an IOU document. Now, under that circumstances, circumstantial evidence is seen as unsafe and unreliable unless such evidence is allowable in terms of the burden of proof. This is, I'm trying to put it within a legalistic framework. Otherwise, the counsel for a claimant might advise against taking such a case to court, since the chances of winning would be uncertain. Or in the world of scholarship, regarding east to west transmission of knowledge, taking a specific case, and which is what I'll be discussing later, transmission of knowledge will be the analog of IOU, is both a necessary and sufficient condition for acknowledging transmission. Now, if such an analog doesn't exist or is absent, that would entail invisibility. That is my definition, or the condition for invisibility to exist. Now, invisibility demands no mention of any kind be made to any circumstantial evidence, no matter how compelling it is, in overall favor of the claim of transmission. Now, there are some questions that the problem of invisibility exists, and these questions in turn will probably, I'll try to answer that in relation to two examples or two illustrations that I'll take after this. One question is the gold standard canon of evidence entailing invisibility the only relevant evidential canon? The second question, can a case be made for compelling circumstantial evidence as a sound and plausible alternative to the gold standard of proof? A further question is, does an asymmetry exist in the applications of these two kinds of evidence as applied to east to west transmission? East to west, I mean from eastern world to the western world, or from the eastern countries to Europe. That would be an example of that. So, as applied to the east to west, on the one hand, and west to east transmissions on the other, which is from Europe to the sort of eastern world. I'm taking those as specific examples. As you'll see later, I take an example of India and another example from China to illustrate this point. Another question. Would the compelling circumstantial evidence or even less suffice in the case of west to east transmission, while gold standard of proof is required in the case of the east to west transmission? What one is suggesting in this case is that you got two different types of evidence that's needed. One is stronger than the other. In case of transmission from west to east, is less strong, while from east to west, you need the gold standard of proof, which is a much stronger evidence. Now, my first illustration, and this is something incidentally we are working on, and I have not seen this covered in any history of mathematics, as far as I know, in any great detail, is what I call the discovery of the mathematics of equal temperament in China. Now, let me hasten to add that this involves music and different things about music, so I don't really know much about music. My colleague who is working with me, which is Kikok Lee, is the one who is much more conversant with the musical thing. So I'll really have to go through it. I constructed these transparency on the basis of what she has told me about music and equal temperament. Now, the starting point is there is a work which is not terribly well known on equal temperament by Zhu Zaiyu, who's lived between 1536 and 1611 in the Ming Dynasty, during the Ming Dynasty, and that's the textbook, and that was written between 1567 and 1581. Now, I got some things on the context in which this particular discovery was made. Now, the first thing to remember is that the ancient Chinese music is not just a matter of entertainment and amusement, but it had a very important role in the rites and rituals of the court. There was an existence of a belief that the downfall of a dynasty was caused by a flaw in the ritual music of that court. So that every dynasty from the time of the Zhu dynasty was dictated by the need to establish a correct ritual music to prolong its survival. So basically the survival of any rule depended on getting the correct ritual music. That's the context in which it developed. And continuing with the context, the correct ritual music required that the scale and tonal pitch used agreed with numerical ratios, reflecting the relative positions representing the planets. So it was tied up with also astronomy. So, for instance, the 12 tones also represented the cyclical return of a 12-month year. So there was an attempt at tying up music, mathematics, calendar, as well as astronomy. Now, each month had its own fundamental pitch. Thus, so the symbolic meaning and cosmological significance could be bestowed on the relationship between the musical pitch and the calendar month. Now, this is the crucial thing. Zhu believed that by introducing a new system of ritual music, the fortunes of the court could be restored and the decline of the Ming dynasty was arrested. Incidentally, he was a minor prince of that particular Ming rule. And so he was very concerned about the decline in the Ming dynasty and also the corruption and other things that he found. And he felt that this could in turn be alleviated by introducing more correct ritual music. And so equal temperament was part of this armory of actually improving the fortunes of the court through ritual music. Now I got some stuff on, this is where I'm dependent on my colleague Kikok Lee. What is equal temperament? Now, it's a system of tuning in which every pair of adjacent notes has an identical frequency ratio. So in such cases, an interval, usually an octave, is divided into a series of equal steps or equal frequency ratios. Now, it's interesting to note that both modern Western music and traditional Chinese music, the most common tuning system is to divide the octave into 12 equal parts, which are known as the semitones, and usually starting with a standard pitch of 448Z in both things. Now, this is the mathematical bit. The concept of equal temperament begins with the recognition, and this is something that Pythagoras, as early as Pythagoras' time, this was known. Concept of begins with the recognition that the ratio of tones in octave is 1:2, or 4:8, or 8:16, and the perfect fifth produced by vibrations in the ratio of 3:2. These ratios had been known for a long time as resulting pure and perfect notes. Anything that varied from these ratios, in fact, resulted in what were known as monkey tones or dissonant or discordant music. Now, so in an equal, in a 12, though octave is supposed to be 8, normally it's a 12-tone equal temperament system that one is talking about, whether it's the Chinese ritual music or Western music. Which divides octave into 12 equal parts, a question arises as to the ratio of frequencies between two adjacent semitones. Now, this is a problem that has actually puzzled people for many years. How do you do that? Dividing the octave into 12 equal parts, so what would be the ratio of frequency between the two adjacent semitones? According to Zhu, this ratio, that's the ratio of the frequencies R between two adjacent semitones, is the 12th root of square root of 2. And he worked this out to 24 decimal places, what the 12th root of square root of 2 is. Now, he achieved this division by calculating the 13 notes of the scale, including the fundamental note, assumed here to have the value 1. In the following ratios, it wasn't one in Zhu's case, but it was a certain set of arbitrary numbers. But we'll take it as one. So basically what you had is as follows. 1:1 to start with, then 1:2 to the power 1/12. And then it should be, basically there's a 1:2 to the power 2/12, 1:2 to the power 3/12, and so on, right up to 1:2 to the power 12/12. So basically you had to get as a fundamental thing the calculation of the 12th root of 2. Now, the beauty of his computational procedure is has an elegance and simplicity that is quite worthy of note, because he needs only 3 steps to arrive at the value of the 12th root, and I've just put that in modern symbolic form as, first of all, finding the square root of 2, find the square root of whatever is the answer, and then finding the cube root of that particular quantity. So you end up with the 12th root of square root of 2. And he did this using just the abacus. Now, this is the question now. Basically, what can we say about the priority of this mathematics? Because this was according to students of music, this was one of the greatest discoveries that was made, this mathematics of the equal temperament, basically in this case finding the 12th root of square root of 2 as being the particular ratio between the adjacent semitones. And the question now comes to priority and transmission of these ideas. Now, who did this first? 3 people usually mentioned are Mersenne, and the figure that is usually given for his publication is 1636-7, Steven, 1595 or slightly later, or Zhu, who is not later than 1581. So these are the three. So on the basis of this, the priority would be, of course, Zeus. Now, interestingly, if you look through a whole lot of the books on this, and I got for those who are interested, I got a list of these books with me here. Why is this not better known, or why is this particular information? Quite often, Stevinus usually credited with this by those who are theorists of the particular music or the history of music. And I suggest that maybe it is a form of invisibility, which I defined earlier. Could this knowledge have been transmitted from China to the West? Now we come to the transmission idea. The question then arises, what is the problem of proof? How do you show that any knowledge is transmitted from China or from country A to country B? Now, who were the agents? And I'm going to make the conjecture that they were the Jesuits. Now, let's take this a bit further now. How do I establish transmissions? Now, obviously, there is nothing in either Stevin or Mercian's book that the ideas, if you establish transmission from China to the West, there's nothing in either Mercian or Stevin's book which suggests that the ideas came from China. So, you can't use a golden standard of proof in this case because there is no written evidence. So what is your particular path is called the compelling circumstantial route. Now what does this involve? And this is something that we suggest as a way of approaching it. First of all, establish a chronology of priorities of occurrence. Now, priority, I don't think there is a lot of doubt now that Zeus was prior to the other two. Though between Zeus and Stevin, that the difference in the sort of the lapse of time wasn't that great, but there was still a lapse of time. Secondly, establish the agency and the existence of accessible communication routes. This is the opportunity element. Now, in this case, one is conjecturing that the agency were the Jesuits, and I'll go on to sort of say more about that. Third is you have to establish motivation and or intention to borrow. Motivation is very strong because, as pointed out, that after Bach's work, there was a general strong need to be able to devise a method of obtaining the equal method of ensuring that an equal temperament operated. So there is very strong motivations, not so much for various reasons in China as it was in Europe. And I think Bach's work was a fundamental starting point of this increase in motivation. In fact, Goodall, one of the writers, suggests that there was such a great interest in finding out a particular mathematical way of ensuring equal temperament that once the solution was reached on that, it was one of the, he calls it one of the big bangs in the history of Western music. Finally, there's identifying the methodological, algorithmic, or epistemological similarities or dissimilarities between the two particular cultures that one is talking about, which I've called as similarities. Now, agents and routes of transmission. Now, we have argued that, I won't go into it in great detail, but that there are two possible routes and both involve the Jesuits. Now, there is evidence that there was a biannual fair that was held in Macau. And say 1580 and 1582 were, for examples, there, where there was a whole lot of, not just exchange of goods alone taking place, but a lot of Westerners, including Jesuits, came to this particular fair, and this was a possible route for the transmission of these ideas on equal temperament. Another, and possibly it could be also it could also be both of these operating together, was the second route was starting with zoo. Now, we had next one of Matteo Ricci. By the way, those who are not familiar with Matteo Ricci is one of the great names of a Jesuit who actually, what we know about him now in a lot of the histories of science is that he took a lot of ideas both in astronomy, in mathematics, from the West to China. For instance, he was the first person who, with the help of some Chinese scholars, translated Euclid into Chinese. His work on astronomy, astronomical works, particularly providing some introduction to Western astronomy, was something also he wrote about that. He was one of the great figures in this sort of interchange between China and Europe. Now, one of his disciples was called Li, who was also the director at one stage of the Bureau of Rituals in the Chinese court. And he was bound to have known something about Zhu's work, and as a disciple of Ricci, and of course Ricci himself was quite well knowledgeable about music. He took some particular musical instruments to China, apart from mechanical clocks and others, which was quite a sensation in the court itself. Now, the argument is that this is the particular line: Zhu to Li, Li to Ricci, Ricci to Clavius, who was actually at one stage, he was both a teacher of Ricci as well as he was the professor of mathematics in the Collegio Romano, which was the main Jesuit institution. He's quite an important name in the history of mathematics at that point in time. Now, through Clavius, there was Trigault, who in fact translated some of Ricci's journals, which also includes a mention of music. And then through that, translations went to Stevin, and from Stevin went to Mersan, because some of the work done by Stevin was in turn passed on to Mersan, who wrote, both Stevin and Mersan wrote on equal temperament. So, this is the two possible routes. Now, possible similarities between the works of these three people, I won't say any more because at the moment there is work in progress relating to that. Now, however, one of the things that we are toying with is the idea that since there is no documentary evidence relating to it, we suggest that the mode of transmission is what we call a minimally cautious mode of transmission. And basically, it works in the following way. Now, there are three possible options as far as Ricci's knowledge of Zhu's work go. One is that Ricci never heard of or never was aware or never knew in part or in entirety of Zhu's work on equal temperament. That's one option or one possibility. The other possibility is Ricci knew about Zhu's work but failed to appreciate its significance and hence ignored it. mentioning it to not at all in any way, not transmit the news to anyone who could be interested back in Europe. So he knew the work, but there was no, he didn't know the significance of the work. Third is that Ricci did know of Zhu's work and appreciated its significance, but failed to speak in his own writing about Zhu's innovative contributions. Now we come to the conclusion, after a set of arguments, that if that three is the most likely, the most plausible of the options. And in that case, the question is, since it doesn't appear in Zhu's writing, so what do you do? Now, this is what we are now suggesting as a conjecture. Basically, up to now, we think in terms of documents being passed on. It is quite possible that the information may have been put in its barest form on some piece of paper with no mention of sender or recipient, which was not to be filed away or achieved once a message had been read and copied. Now, the argument for this is quite complicated, but basically what we are suggesting is that one has to understand the position of the Jesuits at that time. One has to understand what the purpose of their mission was. Their position was that they were quite vulnerable because they were seen by the establishment as being a bit too clever by half, the Jesuits. Because in a sense, they were among some of the most educated and some of the most learned of the part of the Catholic Church. They were always in the danger. I mean, there was suspicion of their being sympathetic to Galileo's ideas, for instance. And so they were really in quite a vulnerable position, and the last thing they would do is to sort of bring strange ideas from the East. Okay. Now, one would also sort of further argue that, basically that's a vulnerability of them. Secondly, there is an interesting case of how some of the information was sort of passed on. Basically, that we have discovered that some of it takes the form of little notes that they write, and then it is sort of passed on to particular people who may be interested. In case of some mathematical results, it would be some result. For example, I mean, there is evidence of some thing, I mean, in a different case, which I'll just consider, of some mathematical ideas being passed on by a Jesuit called Schreck to Vietti, and both of them are sort of classmates. Anyway, I won't go a lot more into this, but basically what one is suggesting is that these could have been passed on without actually being an important part of the document. And then there is another very important thing. A lot of Jesuit records tend to have either been still in private sources. They are not in archives that you find, in Vatican or in Lisbon or other places, but they may be in private papers. And a number of them were destroyed after the Jesuits were banned, because nobody would actually keep these records, because the Jesuits were no longer considered to be organizations which had any legal entity as far as the Catholic Church went. Now, let me see what time it is. I want to very quickly go through another illustration. This is with Kerala maths, and this is what we've been working on for some time, including... Now, basically, these were the various methods of testing a transmission hypothesis. But this is case of Kerala maths. By the way, Kerala mathematics, for those who are not familiar with it, this is sort of mathematics on some quite remarkable mathematics taking place in Kerala, which is one of the states southwest of India, where between the sort of 14th and the 17th century, there was mathematics relating to infinite series, particularly trigonometric series, sine, cosine, arctan, as well as various other work, both used in astronomy as well as for other reasons. You find that. And so it's that sort of mathematics that I want to sort of consider. Now, these are the ways that you check on it: priority, communication routes, methodological similarity, motivation, evidence, etc. Now, priority, there is no doubt about it at all. The priority is certainly in Kerala. The discovery of these series around sort of 1350, and the similar work was done, similar discoveries were made in Europe around the 17th century. So there is no problem about priority. Motivation, what are the motivations? Basically, the following motivations were suggested: the needs of the calendar, the movement, say, from the need to have a new calendar was then recognized. So the Gregorian calendar was sort of constructed on the basis of because of some of the limitations of the Julian calendar, the need of global navigation. And this arose both from inaccurate calendar, inaccurate astronomy, and finally knowledge that Indian astronomers had worked out this problem using spherical trigonometry to carry out the corrections. Now, I've just got a few quotations just to Matthew Ricci, one of the Jesuits who came to Kerala, say, before he went to China. He's been requested to apply himself to the scientific study of this new and imperfectly known country, which is India. Then Antonio Rubino writes from India, these are all part of the intent, in 1610 to report on inaccuracies in European mathematical tables, and further that some of these inaccuracies had actually been sorted out in the tables that he came across in India. Schreck, these are all scientists who were quite well knowledgeable in both mathematics and astronomy. Schreck, he reports on astronomical observations intended for the benefit of Kepler in 1618. There were further things as well. There is documentary evidence from the Jesuit archives that we got, including this sort of mention about particular sets of tables and other things, and navigational devices which, as the quotation suggests, which were an improvement on the ones that were being used by the Europeans. I think that is clear. De Mensis' letter from... De Mensis, incidentally, was one of the Jesuit superiors who wrote this particular letter. This is from the document Indica. Now, there is the request of Matthew Ricci to Muffy, where he states he wants the assistance of an intelligent Brahmin or an honest mode to help him understand the local ways of recording and measuring time. There is finally documentary evidence from the Jesuit archives, and this is a very intriguing thing because it's, I'll just read through this. This book has been written, this is a book that Clavius wrote, has been written with great ingenuity and learning. We also believe that the book in question is going to be particularly useful concerning the reform of the calendar. We thus most strongly exhort you to continue soon to elaborate on and further expound these Indian matters. We don't know what the Indian matters are, which you are successfully conversant with for the state, for the benefit of the state. So, these are the sort of documentary evidence. Now, basically, from our research that we have conducted, and we've done work on sort of Kerala mathematics and the possibility of transmission, what we get is a whole set of evidence of this sort, which is sort of quite patchy in this case. Now, going back to what I said about, do they constitute compelling circumstantial evidence? I've just given you a few examples. There are something like 20 or 25 of these. That's an interesting question. Do they Now, when you're talking about circumstantial evidence, and this is true in law as well, what you would be concerned with is issues like motivation, opportunity, are there any direct evidence, in the, etc. Now, using the same particular categories or rules as in the case of law, the question then comes, is this evidence compelling enough? Now, obviously, we don't have any direct evidence. In fact, it's extremely unlikely we'll find any evidence to suggest that, which says something like, this particular method was found from Kerala and an explanation after that. That type of evidence is very unlikely to exist, given the motivations of, given the reasons why the Jesuits went to Kerala and China in the first place, and also because of the nature of the, also because of the particular nature of the type of interaction that took place between the native population and the Jesuits who went there. Now, I think I've given two examples to illustrate this. The one on the Kerala mathematics, there's a lot more. I think if there are any questions, I would certainly be quite happy to respond to them or answer them. But I wanted to bring to your notice what is we see as sort of fairly quite new work, which is on equal temperament. Now, so going back to where we started from, the next stage in looking at the history of non-Western mathematics is basically going into this whole question of not only what is mathematics as we understand it, but also trying to see primarily whether for various reasons the mathematics of certain traditions are invisible as I defined it earlier. Now, an important element in this discussion about whether it's invisible or not is the issue of transmission. So, in the new edition of the Crest of the Peacock, I'm hoping to sort of treat transmissions much more. Simply because I feel, as I said earlier, that a number of the issues that I raised in the first edition as things like Eurocentrism, the lack of sufficient treatment of non-Western mathematics, all these have to be now modified, particularly given that this tremendous growth in the work that has sort of taken place on that. Now, for instance, there is actually a very good source book on when it comes to non-Western mathematics, particularly the written documentary evidence, and of course that is that's a book that's been edited by Victor Katz, that's just come out fairly recently. But there remains one area which I think is still a rather gray area. This is the mathematics which is not part of a written, where there is no written evidence, but this is mathematics which is part of cultures where there is no writing. I'm thinking of things like, for instance, the type of mathematics relating to some of the African cultures, where you have to go to the object itself. Paulus Gerdes and others have done a lot of work on it. But the problem with what one describes as ethno-mathematics in inverted commas is that it's very difficult often to trace the history of these things. For instance, you go into sand drawings, which is a part of Paulus Gerdes' work. Now, basically, we don't really know much about the history of it. We know that it is being practiced, or it was practiced until recently. But since there are no documentary evidence, we don't really know what is a historical aspect of it. We do know something relating to things like artifacts such as, say, the Ishango bone in Africa and various things of that sort. But that is an area that I'm not been able to expand as much as I wanted in writing the third edition. Mainly because I think I have a problem with, since it's a book on the history of non-Western mathematics, where is the sort of historical dimension to that? That I'm not sure about. Anyway, I think I'll stop there, and thank you very much.